This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
Welcome, everybody, to the 9th episode of Comics in Black and White. With me this week is Dennis. Once again, 2 weeks ago, we were here with Poison Elves for you. And this week, we are here with Lone Wolf and Cub. So last week was a book that that you brought to my attention, Dennis, and this week was one that I wanted to do, and you just, as soon as I mentioned it, you wanted to jump on board with it. I'm excited to talk Lone Wolf and Cub. We've done Usagi Yojimbo earlier in the life of this podcast, and that was what brought my attention to Lone Wolf and Cub. What brought you to Lone Wolf and Cub?
Mine was actually quite by accident. I was at my original LCS, back where I grew up before I moved, and I was in there getting some books, and he had gotten, this is probably 98, 99, 2000, that era. And I think Dark Horse had just started, gotten the rights to print them. It had started, I think, in the early 90s with First Comics bringing it over, but they only got 45 issues released, which wasn't even, God, a fifth of it. And then it hadn't been anybody printed it, and Dark Horse decided to print the, reprint it, bring it to the U.S., and in the original format of the manga, in the size, except you don't read it right to left. They translated it to reading it left to right. But he had gotten one of the retailer incentives, which was the leather-bound version of the first issue. You know, one per store, one of those things. And he had it there, and I was in the mode of just the great speculation mode I still from the 90s. And I saw it, and I thought, oh, this could be worth something someday. So I bought it. And so I had it sitting there, and then I picked up and read it and just fell in love with it. And then over the next 12 years, I picked up volumes and finally finished it. So awesome. it's got like 28 volumes.
Yeah, I have the first omnibus, and there's 11 omnibus of this, and I think that each omnibus is a little over three of the volume sizes that you have. You sent me a picture of what you have. Yeah, it's kind of a trip reading it. Like you said, it's in kind of manga size, so it's like trade paperback novel, not comic trade paperback size. So you're reading it, you feel like you have a Stephen King book or something with the size that it is, you know, the cheapest printing you could find of a novel like that. So it was kind of odd, interesting for me reading a book that size when you're used to comics being bigger than that, pocket size.
And I've tried to decide if that makes the art better, or if it could be better larger, because, you know, it's in the size that they originally drew it for. And I guess compared to last episode, when we were talking about Poison Elves, which was what, a black and white indie self-published, self-taught artist and everything. You switch over to Lone Wolf and Cub, and it's just, I mean, the art's just beautiful. And I mean, there are some, you know, it's not your traditional manga where you've got all the characters have the big eyes. So I think the artist, and I'm probably going to, you know, I'm hoping not to do their names too bad, but the artist is Goseki Kojima. And he was, a traditionally trained artist. Well, I actually said he was self-taught in painting advertising posters and movie theaters posters during, he was born in 1928, so that must have been in the 30s and the 40s, World War II. I mean, I think he's considered a very influential artist now in Japan. I know that the new series that Dark Horse came out that just finished up earlier this year, New Lone Wolf and Cub, the artist that did that was inspired by his art, and it looks really just about like he just, the same artist did that series also. But the art in it's just beautiful, very detailed, and it just works for this size. And again, this is the beauty of black and white comics, about how just ink, how we can give the depth and the motion and just the sound effects, to this comic. And I don't even really want to call it a comic.
Yeah, it definitely has a different feel to it. It's not doesn't have any sort of a traditional comic feel. This feels more like, an illustrated history almost.
And I think that's what they really highlight, that it's research for Edo period Japan, and it's very, very detailed research, because they're trying to recreate a lot of Edo Japan, the time of the samurai and Bushido and everything.
Yeah, and they say at the beginning, there's a note to the readers where they say that there's a lot of stuff that they won't translate because the translation really wouldn't be true to what it is. So they'll have words in there that aren't translated, but then they'll have like a little asterisks or something and they kind of tell you what it means, but you get a lot of it out of context. I was also used to that with reading Usagi Yojimbo, because even though Usagi is Stan Sakai, it's a more of a cartoon style of art, where this is a more realistic style of art. So both styles of art really aren't traditional, like if you just think comic book art styles. One's a cartooning style, this one's more realistic. But both of them are heavily researched, based in history, based in stories. By stories, I mean like mythology, that sort of thing. And it was interesting, having read a lot of Usagi before reading this, to see the similarities. There's a difference in that this book more graphically depicts violence and sex and stuff like that. It's not exactly heavy in the sex, but when it's part of the story, you know, they aren't overly explicit, but they're explicit in what's going on. Whereas in Usagi Yojimbo, they kind of insinuate and sidestep it, but you really, like, just getting the sense of what's going on can be almost more impactful that way. But this is interesting seeing how they, you know, one isn't hiding anything, the other one is keeping it a little bit cleaner, but they both really accomplish the same thing with what they do.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I was going to ask, did this influence Usagi Yojimbo? Because this here started in 1970, and I think Usagi started mid-80s?
Yeah, this was definitely one of the influences, which is what drew me into it. Reading Usagi, and I just fell in love with it so much. Like a lot of people, I was kind of standoffish with it because it is, you know, cartoon animals, basically. But it really goes to show that you need to give something a try before you say whether or not you like it. I was a Ninja Turtle fan before I was reading Usagi, so it's not like I wasn't already reading anthropomorphic animals of some sort. But I wasn't sure if I wanted to dive into more. But, you know, Usagi had been in Ninja Turtles, which is what was my first exposure to it. But then I had a friend who was also a big Ninja Turtle fan, Kathan, who kept on telling me that Usagi was great. He is a bigger Usagi fan than he even is a Ninja Turtles fan. So I finally gave it a try. And as soon as I dipped my toes into it, I stopped where I was at. I went back and started buying it from the very beginning, because I just knew it was going to be something that I was going to go head over heels into. Once I got into it that deep, I started looking at it, and I haven't even finished reading it. There's 7 Dark Horse omnibus of it, and plus before that, there's 2 Fantagraphics omnibus of Usagi. So right now, there's 9 omnibus out. I've read through the 2 Fantagraphics and the first 2 Dark Horse, so I still have 5 more to go. But I already started looking, okay, what are the influences to it? Akira Kurosawa movies was a big influence. I had never even watched a Kurosawa movie. And, you know, I had always known who he was, but that was about it. So I finally watched, there was one on Netflix, Kagemusha. So I watched that one first and then kept on watching for a way for me to get Seven Samurai without it costing a fortune, because none of his movies are ever cheap. I found a pretty good deal on 4 of his movies used in a Criterion collection. And once I watched Seven Samurai, I was sold on him. So at that point, if it's a big influence on Stan Sakai, it's probably worth checking out. Lone Wolf and Cub in Usagi, they have a story that's Lone Goat and Kid that's based off of Lone Wolf and Cub, exactly. So it was really cool reading this and seeing that. One thing that's been cool with reading Usagi and seeing when he takes influences from something is you can really, like, the influence is very obvious. Like, some of his stories are, parody is not quite the right word, but they're, you know, a parody or an homage of something. So it's really just taking it and doing it in the Usagi style. And the Lone Goat and Kid had that feel of, it was very blatantly reminiscent of Lone Wolf and Cub.
Yeah, it's influenced a lot of things. And I actually got one night just YouTubing, because I think Lone Wolf and Cub set off a bunch of a TV series and some movies there in Japan. Probably, I can't remember, late 70s or early 80s. And it's interesting to sit there and watch it, because I think the Lone Wolf and Cub, one of the movies, I think, has the distinction of having the most kills in a in a movie. And you watch Ogami Ito go through the single strokes, and it's a movie too. So it's like, I don't want to say it's a B movie. But it's kind of funny. And you sit there and see him just go through this storm of like 300 ninja and other fighters and everything, and then with single sweeps, just killing them, and over the course of like 10 minutes. It's highly entertaining if you go on YouTube and you start looking up some of the sequences from the Lone, and I think they were called the Baby Cart series. So I don't know. I don't think it's called Lone Wolf and Cub. I think it's Baby Cart. So if you YouTube and you Google Baby Cart movies, then I think these will pop up. And it'd be really interesting if they actually turned this into a serious live action movie. Of course, I don't think you could do it over all 28 volumes.
No, that definitely have to be. It's just some stories. They do have. I haven't watched it, but in keeping my eyes peeled for Criterion Collection, Kurosawa things, and stuff of that nature, because it seems like Kurosawa movies, the only ones you could find are Criterion Collection. So there's some stores out here that actually divide out Criterion Collection movies. I mean, even Barnes & Noble, if you go there, like, they have a Criterion Collection section. So I'm always just kind of keeping my eyes open. It's rare that you find something like Kurosawa that's a used copy of it. Like, the one that I found, the only reason I found it is the you've, I'm sure, heard me mention Bold Moves Music, because I mention every time I talk about buying a book. They have several stores, and one of them doesn't have the section separated that way. And I found this Akira Kurosawa box set just in with the, what did they title it? The multi-feature movies, which usually multi-feature movies are really crappy movies that are put together and like sold brand new for $10, you know?
Yep.
So it was just buried there, so I don't think anybody noticed it. And I had gone in there over the course of a couple of months and just kept on, it was still there. I finally looked up the prices of the movies individually, and they're like new. They're $30 each. And this is on DVD, that they're like $30 each still. And this was four movies, and it was used for like $48. So I just finally said, you know, I'm just gonna get it, and I did. I didn't regret it. But it, you know, keeping my eyes open, I stumbled across, they do have a box set of Lone Wolf and Cub. I believe it was a TV series in Japan. So you could get that. It's like $70, though. So
yeah,
someday I'll get that.
So
after,
but anyway, well, it took me a while to get them all, but I did. I didn't want to buy them all in one fell swoop. You know, I'd get one or two a month, and then I'd go a half year and wouldn't get one and everything. But it's a very long epic story, a story of, you know, revenge. I don't think there's any redemption.
Yeah, there really isn't a redemption in it.
So it's like you said before, it depicts everything, the brutality of it, the beauty of it, everything of that period and everything. So
before we dive into the content, the last thing I want to say is, as we've said several times, this is a Dark Horse. Dark Horse is publishing it. And Dark Horse just is so good collecting stuff. They make it affordable and approachable. The Omnibuy are $20 for 16 stories. And if you know how to shop for anything, you can get it for less than that. So like on InStockTrades.com, Dark Horse is always, I think, 40% off. So it's $12. For one of these volumes. It's super cheap for all that you're getting, and it's really good stuff too.
Yeah, and the way I got mine, and I think for your omnibus, it covered two full volumes and then the first two chapters of the third volume. So, and these were when they originally came out, $9.95. And when I went to a used bookstore, a Half Price Books, a couple of weeks ago, I saw they had a full collection there at like $4.95 each. So if you go out to used bookstores, you can find these now, and they're about $5 for a volume, and a volume's about all the none of the chapters are like even. Let's see, and this here goes to about chapter 12. So I got 12 chapters like in the first volume, $10 originally. You can probably find them for half price out there, but I'll tell you, there's going to be 28 of these. So at $5 a piece, that's still, you know, 100. If you can find them, that's still $150 at half price.
Yeah, and just like you said, though, buy it step by step. That's the great thing about Dark Horse publishing it, is you don't have to worry about it disappearing. All right, so let's get into the actual content of this. So we're not going to go issue by issue and talk about every last detail of it, but we'll start leafing through, talk about what has stood out the most to us. So one thing that happens in every story in this is kind of it's formulaic in this way, is that these are all jobs. Like, every single story in this volume that I read is him taking a job and doing the job. It doesn't always start out making it perfectly clear, but that's always the case, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think the way my volumes are is kind of how they've kind of got it into its beats. So you're right. So my first volume has got 12 chapters, and every chapter is pretty much a job of some sort. There's one or two chapters where there's not a job involved, and that's more character development. There's the chapter when you find out the history and why he's doing what he's doing. And then I think there's the chapter, do you remember the story about when he goes to the hot springs?
Yeah.
Okay, I think those are the only two ones that are not where he's taking a job and has to – he's an assassin. So Lone Wolf and Cub, when you first meet him, you see this feudal Japan – man pushing a cart with his son in it. He has a flag on his cart, and it's translated to Lone Wolf and Cub Assassins. Well, I think it says Assassins on it. Everybody knows who Lone Wolf and Cub is. So he's openly advertising that he's an assassin. So let me see. It translates son for hire, sword for hire, names his school, and gives his name. So, and that was one of the interesting aspects. You notice, and he gets into confrontations with other samurai, as is want in feudal Japan. And it's interesting, and I assume this is how it happens in Usagi Yojimbo, is they announce their name, they announce their school, and then they go at each other, and it's usually one strike. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That's what I find interesting with modern interpretations of fights or sword fights or anything, where there are these long, drawn-out things. And in reality, it was like you rushed your opponent, you got one attempt to strike him down and him to strike you, and it was over.
Yeah, I think in American movies, at least, what we think of as sword play is based more on fencing or knights with heavy swords, where it's, you know, you're swinging at each other and hoping to get a hit in. But I think that that the samurai type of swordplay we're seeing in this, it's more like jousting would be, where you're taking one run and you either hit them or they hit you, and if neither one of you hit each other, then it gets messy.
Exactly. So, but anyway, yeah, the book opens up with that, and, you know, he's meeting with an individual. He takes on his standard fee, 500 ryu. I don't know if that may be how you pronounce it. And then he sets off to, you know, fulfill his job. And they use the first chapter to kind of set up how they think and how things work. Because, a good part of the time, his jobs are straightforward. He gets to his target. And another interesting aspect is he announces who he is. It's like, I'm Ogama Ito, assassin. I'm here for you. And the act takes place. But in this one, it was interesting. They go through and they talk about, and it goes basically how he gets himself in front of whoever he's supposed to assassinate. So usually they're having to assassinate somebody that's a high level and they got guards. So he uses trickery. He lets himself be captured, brought in front of the individual he's supposed to kill. He's got his son with him. And, you know, his son is in on it, too. So he asks his son if he has to pee. He says yes. So they undo him so he can let him pee. And unbeknownst to them, he's got weapons hidden in his baby cart. And he uses the weapon to make the assassination and escape.
It's another thing that's a recurring theme in this book is his son peeing being a factor in what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. But what's interesting is you sit there, and the thing is, everything he does is to the Bushido code or to Sun Tzu's art of war. So it's like in his first chapter when he's leaving, you know, the the other officials there, they're talking amongst themselves and they're going over about how perfectly he planned it and how he used the stratagems in the art of war and everything. And they dare not go against him because he pulled this off so perfectly. And so to the tenants, there was so much honor in it that there's no way they can overcome him because their honor can't match up to his honor.
Yeah. And that's a big thing that even he iterates in it is, he goes into everything in a way that when he goes out of the job, he has no fear of repercussion with how he does it. There's always something that's going to protect him from the people hiring him, coming after him. And, you know, he always has a very thoroughly planned out with it. Not only is he clever, he's not just living by the seat of his pants and, you know, he's clever enough to stay one step ahead. Like you see in a lot of stories, you know, like we both read Valiant. Ninjak has been presented that way a lot. He just dives in, but he's always able to stay one step ahead. Aladdin in the Disney cartoon, you know, he has a whole song about it, you know. That's not mm-hmm. what Lone Wolf is doing. He's not just staying one step ahead. He's following rigorous structure of how things should be done, and being so witty in how he does everything that all of his bases are covered. Like, each of his plans is, it's like planning out a chess match. And you see chess greats go into a match, and they know how it's all going to unfold because they know every strategy. So he knows everything that's going to happen.
Yeah, and he does it so honorably that you know, everybody's so dumbfounded. And the thing is, then and his son, Daigoro, is in on it too. He's like 3-4 years old, and it's like, hey, Daigoro, do this, go do that. And it's like they've almost planned things out with how he uses his son to basically turn the advantage to him, because everybody sees the 3-year-old and they just think he has no part in this. And he plays a big part in, you know, how he acts and how he allows his father to get in close. And then all the other different implements that are actually on the baby cart, because he's got the baby and that baby cart's armed to the teeth.
Yeah, it is. In this volume, they have the one story where the kids steal it to use as a sled because they think it's abandoned. And then when they crash the sled, one of the blades pop out and cut one of the kids.
Yep.
And that gets him caught when he's, I believe, trying to recover from something. Do you think his actions are honorable? Because one of the things that stands out is the difference between this and the character of Usagi Yojimbo in that title is Usagi is honorable. He's a ronin, but he's a ronin in, like, the most honorable way to be a ronin. He's not just a ronin because he's a masterless samurai. He's actually taking the journey that is meant to be, and he won't do things that are unhonorable or dishonorable. Whereas Lone Wolf, he's an assassin. He every single job he does, he's not doing it for honor. He's doing it for money. I think he's not so much honorable as he is proper.
Yes. You haven't gotten into the story far enough. So to where a lot of that backstory is explained. If you get the chapter, I forget what it is. It's in the first volume. You find out who he is, like the two stories we talked about, where there's no assassination. There's one where he goes to the hot springs, and he's going to the hot springs to rest, recover, and there's a group of bandits that have taken it over. And,
you know, one of my favorite stories in this volume, too.
Yeah, and, you know, these bandits are terrorizing, they're raping. They're acting like the big man. I mean, they're threatening everything. And he just kind of walks in. It's like, hey, me and my son are going to spend the night. They do stuff to him and all that and force him to do stuff, or they'll kill the people. And he spends the night. And in the morning, you know, they're getting ready to leave. And they tell him they've got the villagers there and they've got some guests. And they're going to kill the guest to force the villagers not to say anything because they keep moving to keep ahead of the authorities. And then Lone Wolf and Cub come out, and they're getting ready to leave, and the guys are going, what are you doing? It's like, we rested, we're going to leave. And they're like, no, you're not. And then finally one of them recognizes him, and he tells the others, it's like, leave him alone. Do not mess with him. And this one guy's like, screw him. And I think he throws something at him. And then he dodges. And then Lone Wolf just throws one of his spears and just impales the guy. Mm-hmm. And then what you find out, you know, the very last thing, he's the one guy that recognizes him sits there and goes, I won't tell anybody, spare me. And the last thing is, I won't tell anybody that you're the Shogun's executioner. And he just kills him and goes on. And then the next story, you finally get his backstory. So Ogami Ito was the Shogun's executioner. And in feudal Japan, you know, Shogun is the emperor who is basically, I don't want to say they're God on earth because they were kind of practicing Buddhist. So this is Buddha, but, you know, he was the ultimate leader, ultimate authority. But he couldn't bring himself down to do duties that would disgrace his holiness or whatever you want to call it. So only somebody of higher rank could perform seppuku on a lower rank. So, you know, that was the ritualistic suicide if you dishonored yourself. So the Shogun's executioner would act as the Shogun and would perform I forget the technical term for it, but once you committed seppuku, your second would then decapitate you to ease the pain after you've already disemboweled yourself. So he represented the Shogun for the rank and file that, or the next below that would report to the Shogun. So that was his role. And the way the government was set up was in three, powers. So you had the Shogun, and you had the Shogun's assassins, the Shogun's spies, and then the executioner. And there was three families that had that. And what you find out is the family that ran the assassins was wanting to get more power, so they framed Ogami's family, the Ito clan, so that he got disgraced and they could take it over. So then you find out that's why he's now a Ronin or an assassin, is because he got framed by out of the Shogun's court. Now what's he doing? He's, you know, running the road, being an assassin. Does he have some kind of ulterior motive for doing that? Is he just going to do that for the rest of his life? Or is he collecting all of the money for some purpose? Is he investigating? Is he roaming around? What exactly is he trying to do? So he's been framed, and he told his son. And, you know, that was a pretty good chapter, that last one there, when he found that all out, because he actually gave Daigoro a choice. It's like he could pick the ball, and then he would basically kill him to join his mother, or he could pick the sword and go with him on the path of the assassin.
Yep, yeah, I think you pretty much just covered over the meat of the story that isn't just the, like, the one-shot stories of the jobs that he's doing. But that was the meat of the story of, I guess, like, the progressive story in the book so far. So like you said, he started off... One of the things about this time in Japan is... pretty much, if you're in power, you can tell somebody to kill themselves.
Yeah, basically. Under you.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's basically the position he's put in. They've set it up to dishonor him so they could say, okay, now kill yourself because we say so, because they want to get him out of the way. So he has to choose to follow honor and do that, which obviously, you know, with real logic, that's not really honor to kill yourself because somebody framed you and then tells you to kill yourself. Or he could take the assassin's road and basically just, like, you know, F all this, I'm just going to start killing people. That's what he decides to do, and that's, you know, all throughout this, every time they talk about it, that is it's a pathway to hell. Like, he knows that that's what it is. He gives his son the opportunity to choose. His son's a baby. He puts out a ball and he puts out a sword or a blade. I can't remember exactly what it was. And just like you said, he basically is telling his son this when his son is too young to know what he's saying. But, you know, if you choose the ball, then you choose to not go on this murderous road with me, and I'll kill you so that way you can go be with your dead mother. Or you come and join me on this, and then your destiny is the same as mine. And that's why throughout the book, he is completely fearless with his son's life, because his son is part of this journey. He's on the road with him. So he's never afraid for his son's life. He's never trying to defend his son. So his son is never a burden to his ends. But his son has been taught to be a means to his ends. So he's a tool to help him. And without that fear of losing his son, there's the one story in here where his son is waiting in the cave for him, but he gets buried under an avalanche. And he just is like, he's probably dead. We'll see when I'm done.
I'll be back in 5 days. We'll check then.
Yeah, and fortunately, he causes another avalanche that pushes away the first one, and his son's fine. It's a twisted thing, because he is choosing a dishonorable life, but what the honorable thing would have been, you know, ridiculous. He's choosing the dishonorable life because he doesn't accept the dishonor that's really been perpetrated on him. But then to continue going down this road he's on, he has to live a dishonorable life.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think it also said that the rest of his clan was killed. So, like, they're the only ones also left of his clan. So he's been framed. He's been dishonored. His clan's been wiped out. And he knows who did it. They're brazen about they did it. And, you know, he's not just going to go quietly into the night. I mean, it is interesting because then you see the contrast, because there's the story of where one of the lords of the hands, and the hand is Han, I guess that's how they divided it up into like states or provinces or whatever. And there was the one story where you've got the one leader of the hand that's ruining it, and his managers, I forget the Japanese name for it, but the guys immediately under him, his lieutenants, they can't stand to see the hand go down, so they hire Lone Wolf and Cub to kill their master. And once they hire him, they then commit suicide because they've dishonored themselves for having their master killed, but they have to do it so that their hand doesn't get go into even further jeopardy with either the Shogun or a neighboring hand. So it's interesting to see that contrast. Yeah. You know, they're doing a dishonorable act, and they're having to do seppuku to recover from the dishonorable act to save the people that they're charged with saving.
Yeah, that's one thing that in both this and in Usagi, there was a story that was one of the most heartbreaking stories I've read so far in there, about a mother who, when her husband died, her son became the whatever level of ruler it was. I don't know if it was a hand like we're talking about here, or if it was just like kind of a town or whatever. But he was very corrupt, and so this mother saw her son basically destroying everything that the father had taken such good care of, and the only solution is to kill her son. And so throughout, you know, by the end of the story, she does that. And so then she's, sorrowful for having to do it and kind of asking for condolences from Usagi. And Usagi is just like, no, you have to live with what you did, and walks away from her. It's just really heartbreaking because you see that, you know, she had to do what she did for the greater good, but it was still a dishonorable thing to do. The story that you're mentioning here is so crazy. Like, okay, we're going to hire you to do this because this person's corrupt and destroying things, but we still have to kill ourselves because of it.
Yeah, I think that was the one where Degoro got under the avalanche, like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Because the guy met him, he committed suicide, then he met him in the cave, and they were leaving Degoro there, and the four of them were going up, and they were wanting to get Ito into the castle, so he was going to have to fight the four and defeat them so they would trust him. And so they said, we're not going to give any quarter. He says, I'm not going to give any either. And I mean, then he proceeded to wipe them out, and that's how he got into the castle to kill the Lord to save the Han, because he was building a castle, And if he built a castle, it was a direct opposition to the Shogun, and then the Shogun would come in and just crush everything. So, yeah, it shows how the planning and everything that went into all these hits, because they just keep getting, I don't want to say elaborate, but, you know, there's subterfuge and using honorable and, or well, I don't want to say honorable, but the ways of the system and the ways of their customs to get in front of the people that he had to get in front of. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, and, you know, that's kind of how it goes. I think if you go, you know, that kind of gets through, I think, the first half of your omnibus there. And then I think the rest of the stories are pretty much the same again, but now you get a little bit more character building. And then you also start to get a little bit more involved in the fights, about what's involved in them. Like you start to see, instead of your generic Ronin or generic samurai, you start seeing characters that have unique skills and abilities. Like there was the three brothers he had to face.
Yeah.
And, you know, in their school of fighting. And I find that interesting when they sit there and they start talking about the schools of fighting. Like there's one where it's like upward horse stroke. And it's like, how did you counter that? And it's like, my Ryu school of blade, whatever. And, you know, it's like those old 70s kung fu movies where my kung fu is mightier than your kung fu. Mm-hmm. About how they keep going through all that. But I think the next interesting story that came in there was the living Buddha. How'd you like that story? Where he could not, until he became, what was it, cleansed his mind of all thought and all intent, he could not kill this one man who was the living Buddha of the village. Mm-hmm. And so you had this whole story of where he's sitting there and he's meditating, you know, be one with the tree, be one with the mountain, be one. And he's up on this mountain and there's these wolves, and you've got to become so, I don't know, empty that the wolves will leave you alone. And so he has to fight the wolves every so often. He finally does it. And then at that point, then he can go kill this living Buddha of this village, which is again, it's where some of the higher, the people responsible for the safety of the Han need to raise taxes, but the Buddha won't let them. So they keep getting more and more in debt. And so they have to do the dishonorable thing to hire him to kill somebody, to say, you know, to do the honorable thing of saving the Han. And that also seems to be a recurring theme in here, is like, you know, does a dishonorable act get canceled out by the honorable intentions of it?
Yeah, that's an interesting dichotomy in this, is over and over we're seeing that, where to do the honorable thing would be to let the person in charge basically destroy something, whether it be people, whether it be the town, whether it be something greater than that. So people are having to be dishonorable to save people, but, you know, it's like saving people isn't the most honorable thing. It's a difficult dichotomy for us to really process. So you see just over and over and over again in this where, you know, they're the only people who are really logically out for themselves are like the bandits, where it's just all about them. Going back to Seven Samurai, there's the one guy who in this of the seven that isn't actually a samurai. He's a farmer, but his family was killed by samurais who came and just bled them dry, basically, because they would just come and take and take and take from the farmers. And there's the point where they're in this village that they're trying to protect. That's the whole, you know, the center of the story. And they realize that all these farmers in this village, who they think of as just being something kind of lesser, and they realize that they're hoarding food and they're hoarding alcohol and they're hoarding all these things and hiding it away. And they get this, you know, well, you know, screw these people. You know, they're just out for themselves. But then they start to realize, because this one samurai that's really a farmer tells them, that's what everybody, you know, if you're not living honorable and just going to sacrifice yourself because somebody tells you to, then you're out for yourself. And that's it's a strange world where, you know, logic and honor are definitely not the same thing.
No, exactly. So I guess get back on some more of the technical aspects. How do you like how they do the fight scenes in here? I mean, because, you know, they'll zoom in on a little piece of the action, and then you have almost like the splash page shot and back and forth. I really like, you know, how the artist, you know, breaks up his panels, and, you know, you'll have all the detail in the panel, then you'll have the panel where it's just a little bit of detail, then you got the blur of all the motion on it to kind of convey how the fight's going and everything. It's just really well done.
Yeah, and I feel like his style even is developing a lot as this goes on. Particularly earlier on, there were times where you just really couldn't tell what was happening. And as you go on, he does a better job of giving a sense of where the line of the motion is, which kind of guides you through the image to see what's going on in a lot of action being in a still picture, basically. I'm on this one panel of this fight scene. It's the layouts are interesting in this sometimes. Like, in this, it's two pages, and there are... There's a panel on the top third of the left page and a panel on the top third of the right page. There's a big panel that runs across the middle of both pages, and there's four more panels on the bottom. So you get a sense of these people standing back watching him coming. Then you get their view of the people in front of them that are already recoiling at Lone Wolf coming through them. He's going up against a lot of people here. Then you get the big panel across the middle where he's in the midst of it all. Then you go down to the bottom panels where you start to see people flying back, limbs flying off, heads flying off. So the way they kind of build it up, you get this this sense of tension of death is just coming our way. Then you get it's in the midst of everything, and then everything is flying apart. That it does a lot to really build the violence of the scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really dynamic, and it's just really something to say about how he can do that with just black and white. And do you also notice that there seems to be some, you know, he's got a style, but every once in a while, then you'll get a page where it looks like he watercolored it or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that seems to have no rhyme or reason, but then it works. I mean, it's almost like the big cinematic pullbacks pages is when it looks like it's just got a little bit more or a different style. Like he's gone either pastel or watercolor, or there's more shading or something in it.
Yeah, he definitely has the occasional page that is just really highly detailed, watercolored. And then you get some pages where the action just gets so hot and heavy that the detail drops down a lot. And then after the page I was just talking about that builds the action, you go to the next page, and it's Lone Wolf in the middle. And it's definitely kind of a sketchier style, less detailed in this. Everything around him is kind of grayed out. And you see a lot of letters depicting the sound of what's happening and a lot of just like kind of white slash marks through it. So it just gives you the sense like after this page that really builds one moment, it just gives the sense of he's working through just this field of people killing everybody. And then the very next panel is everything is kind of normal brightness around him and just everybody's dead. Everybody's down.
Yep.
As we talked about earlier with the one-on-one fights, about how it's not a big battle that stretches on. It's they prepare, they get set, and they basically take one shot at each other. These big battles, I think what most people would be used to in a big battle is them highlighting these different moments where, you know, even if it's one guy against a ton, it's almost like they're coming up to him one at a time. So he could, okay, I'm going to chop your head off. I'm going to stab you through the chest. Okay, on to the next person. I'm going to do this. But that's not how it is when you're being attacked by all these different people. You're defending and attacking everybody at the same time, so they can't depict that. It would, you know, it'd be a mess if they tried to depict that. So doing these scenes where it gives you kind of a sense of motion and gives you, like, the fringe effects of the violence, but it doesn't really focus in on the individual details of what's happening, because that's not really the reality of what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, he's just leaving it up to you, but it's more realistic, where it's not one-on-one. You know, these are like when he's fighting peasants, or I guess warrior class that's not samurai, and they're coming at it mass, and they're coming out from all sides and everything at the same time. And the key is also, Deigoro's on his back, mm-hmm. and he's doing all this. He's like, he like tells Deigoro, okay, hold on tight. If you don't hold on, it's, you're on your own.
It's funny, reading through this the first time, I was loving it. I was going through it pretty quickly. You know, but I read through the stories, and I'd be like, well, yeah, these are a lot of good stories, but I wonder how many are really going to stand out to me afterwards. It seemed like, you know, there'd probably be a handful that stood out. But as I look through this, all of these stories, really, when you kind of flip back to the beginning of them and see what they are, these are all some, like, there's meat to every single one of these. It's not like any of them are just kind of action throwaways. I'm in the last few of them, and there's Tragic Osu, and Osu is basically the lowest level of servant in a household, so it's like a young girl. So this household mm-hmm. gets this Osu. Lone Wolf's son is just playing, and he basically gets bullied by the young lord of the household. So the, you know, it's a kid, but he's cub. He's, you know, Lone Wolf's cub, so he knows how to kill people and stuff. So he pulls out a sword and slashes at the kid.
I think he takes the kid's own sword and slashes at him.
Just yeah,
takes it from him.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens.
And he's like half his age and half his size.
He's three. He's a 3-year-old. And so they capture him, and you know they're figuring out what to do with him, and they know the stories of Lone Wolf and Cub, so they figure out, and so then they start getting paranoid, thinking that Lone Wolf is there to get them. So they're being pretty abusive to the kid, and then the Osu, this young girl, has mercy on him basically, and Deigoro refers to her as sister, just as a term of endearment. But they think that it's actually his sister, so, oh, we didn't know Lone Wolf had a daughter, so they're trying to beat a confession out of her. So, I mean, they're just ready. They think Lone Wolf is there to them. They're beating the crap out of these kids, trying to get something out of them. Deigoro has been raised to deal with stuff, so he's not flinching. He finally gets free and goes and gets his dad. This is one of the few stories in this that he's not there for a job. But he goes and he kills everybody.
Well, what's hilarious is, like, yeah, he goes and I think his dad's recovering from a fever.
Yeah, so he comes in there hallucinating and hardly able to function.
Yeah, but Deigoro goes in and he doesn't actually ask his dad for help. He goes in and grabs his dad's sword. He starts to walk out with it, and it's great because his son goes, "I don't know what you've done, but can you reap what you've sown?"
Yeah.
So he's kind of like, well, you got yourself into this, you got to get yourself out. So,
yeah, this is one of those stories that leaves you feeling like you want, you know, whenever you read something, you have to align yourself with the protagonist of the story. That's one of the great things about reading literature is it makes you think more empathetically with other people, even if they're terrible people sometimes. You know, you read some books that the protagonist is a bad person, but if you're going to read it, you have to empathize with them because you have to understand them. Mm-hmm. So when you're reading this, whenever you're in that position to empathize with somebody, you want to feel like they're good. You want to see the good in them and the honor in them. That's one of the stories where it's such a nice, like, you know, he's giving these bad people their comeuppance.
Well, he is. It's nice though, because they come up and he's just like, "I don't know what's going on. You know, can we talk about it?" And they kind of give him the look, pull the swords, and he just goes, "Well, it seems you'd rather not talk." And he just goes, takes care of business. I mean, he kind of, you know, he had no quarrel with him and all that, and he was kind of like, "Hey, you know, okay, just go your way." Nope. All right. And that's when he did the famous, I guess it has to be in every movie, where you catch the sword with your hands, mm-hmm. between the palms of your hands, and he turned that against them. But did you also notice in this story that it's snowing, and then in every panel, or most of the panels, 90% of them, you actually has all the different individual snowflakes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all those details. those are the things that when you're going through this, too, it's easy to not notice the level of details in a lot of this. But those details, that's what adds the details you don't notice add the layers to the art that make it just really suck you in.
Yes, and I mean in the story, the art and everything is just great. And you know, I kind of envy you that you get, you know, you still got what, 11 volumes to go and haven't read it.
Yep.
Because I mean, and it gets a little bit more detailed and you get to learn a little bit more about his plan and you start getting a little bit more politics involved. So I know in the first, like the first volume I got, like story 9, when you meet, you see who it is that frames him. It's the Yagyu clan. And the leader of the Yagyu clan is Ventoro. I think that's his name. I'm trying to find it. You get later in, as you get into the volumes, you find out where he starts hunting him down and sending stuff against him. And now you've got the deeper, you know, political intrigue going on. And, you know, ninjas, because that was the ninja clan is what he was ahead of. And so you start seeing them going against him and all the little, you know, the things like that. Then you start seeing the ninja versus samurai tactics. And, you know, then you start seeing stuff that Ito considers dishonorable that he would never do. I think that, like, the out of all of the chapters in this first volume, like the, from yours, I think the most interesting story was actually the last one when he meets that, I don't know, wandering master.
Yeah, the former samurai that is doing tricks, basically.
Yes, or he's, yeah, and, you know, the trick is, it's like, he puts his head in the mat, and he says, if you can cut it off, you win. and you can use, like, I think he's got swords and spears and hammers and such, and he's just like, hey, for 30 coppers, put your 30 coppers down. If you can take my head off, then you can have all my money.
One of the other, it's an amazing story. So this other samurai who Lone Wolf can see is a master, and he's using his skills to make pocket change, just doing tricks, because he knows that he's not worried about himself getting killed. And he doesn't have to hurt anybody. You know, living a life of killing people, he sees that is not a worthwhile life. So eventually in the story, he basically tells Lone Wolf that he cannot let him continue down the assassin's road. It's, you know, he's honor bound, duty bound to stop him. So they set up their duel, and as they're preparing it, you know, they're set up, and it goes through these gray panels where it's showing all these possible outcomes that can happen.
Yeah, I think that's where they're each thinking. So I guess the point of this story is, like, when two samurai face each other, what's going through their heads? Because I guess if you know which school your opponent's from, you're thinking of, how am I going to counter their move? How are they going to get me? If I do this, oh, okay, he's going to get me this way. And if I do this, oh, he's going to get me this way. And I think that's what those grayed out panels are, is, you know, what's going, they're thinking through. It's like how to approach the duel. So, you know, up until this point, I think you've, what, had 15 stories where it's just like they face each other, they give each other the eye, and then they attack. Here it kind of shows what's going through their head before they do that.
So, yeah, so they go through the process of thinking about what the other will do based on knowing what they know about each other and the school that they come from. What's so cool about this one is they go through all this, so they both know what the outcome should be. But then when they actually move, Lone Wolf is the one who wins this battle. But immediately he says, you should have won. You know, you should have won this fight. And I just love that. I mean, not only just the way they set it up, but for him to be like, what happened? You should have won. So this other samurai knew how to win, still didn't. It has to be intentional. And so, you know, why did he do this? You know, he was doing this because he didn't want to take a life, but he wanted to affect a life. He wanted his actions to have a deeper meaning, to have a bigger meaning than just killing somebody.
Yeah, I think like his last remarks are, it's like think of your child's future return to the world of the living, headless Sakan's dying wish. And he's like, you know.
even if he knows that that lone wolf is pretty much lost, there's this, you know, little child there that even with all that he's been trained to be, there's still a chance for redemption.
Yeah, and then it's like as lone wolf walks away, he you can see him kind of a tear coming from his eye as he mourns the loss of a master that's taught him a lesson, but he still must continue down the path. It's just a really good story. And, you know, it just keeps on like that. So, you know, the author and the artist, they researched it. They planned each story. And it only gets better as you go through it. I mean, I can't say enough about this series. It's a great series.
I really can't wait to get the next volume. We didn't go in depth into all the stories. A few of the other ones that, I mean, by now we're almost going to touch on all of them, but there's the story, the one that we mentioned at the beginning where the kids find his cart and steal it for a sled, and that's how they figure out that this man is hiding in there, and they link him to these murders. So this story, basically, there is a woman who becomes a prostitute voluntarily, and because of this, she also fetches a high price because she's clearly very set apart from the other prostitutes. She does this to save up enough money to hire Lone Wolf to assassinate the people who basically drove her into this, who killed her husband and drove her into this.
Yeah, it was a complicated story how that was.
Yeah, it was a very, very interwoven story where there are all these different pieces that you can kind of see that stuff fits together. But throughout it, you don't know that Lone Wolf was the one who killed the couple that are basically the villains of this story. You don't know why this prostitute killed herself. You know that she comes from the samurai class, so there's no reason she should have been a prostitute. And so just that is shocking in itself. There's missing money, 500 missing ryo. That's Lone Wolf's fee. So by the end, it all comes together. It's just a really beautifully interwoven story. Like, not only is it one of the stories in the book that give you the satisfaction of revenge for a real misdeed being, you know, being exacted, but just it's so well interwoven. You know, some stories try to do this and they just come off really contrived, and this one does not. It just is so well done. That was one of the highlights for me. We talked a little bit earlier about the one with the hot springs. That I think was probably the most brutal story in this book.
And I think that's my favorite out of these first 16 is the hot springs one, because then that's when you realize kind of who you're dealing with. I mean, up until that point, it's just like, hey, here's an assassin. At that point, it's when you start figuring out, oh, there's more to this backstory. There's something interesting going on. You know, people kind of recognize him from his school and everything, but this is the first time somebody recognizes who he is and they're just terrified of him. Mm-hmm. And you've seen him do stuff, because also in that story, I think that's the one where, like, you also get the ones where he's just like sitting there meditating against the wall and somebody will throw a knife or a sword at him to make him flinch, and he won't move, and it might scratch him a little bit, or it'll just be right beside his head and he just won't do anything, and they're all like amazed. I think this is the one where they do that, and it's sitting there, and the guy asks for his dagger back, so he just takes it and he throws it back, and it lands in his sheath.
That was the story with the three other
you're right. That's the three brothers.
That's one of the three brothers. That's a great story too. We'll get to that in a second. This is the one where he goes into the town that's over. It's the hot springs. It's overran by this crew of criminals. And it's just brutal. I mean, in introducing what's going on, you see a guy run down a girl who's just a village girl and rape and kill her just in front of everybody. And yep, it just really sets the tone. It's just absolutely brutal. This was one of the stories that, like, it kind of pushed boundaries for my comfort level with stuff. I really don't like stories that are based on rape. Basically, this one, like, right off the bat, like, that's setting the brutality level of what's going on. So it's a little hard to swallow for me going into this already. So I already really, really want to see him just kill all these people.
Yeah, I mean, it was there to set the tone.
Yeah, and he knows he can't do anything there. He knows that if he defends, and that's where the line between, like, being really honorable and being really precise is drawn in him. Now, he wants to, yeah, I mean, ultimately he wants to get out of there, but he shows throughout it that he also, like, he'll do what he can to protect people who don't deserve to be killed. But in that case, if he tries to protect this girl, it's a fight that he doesn't know if he could win at that point. They, you know, throw him in with the rest of the captured low lives that aren't a part of the group. And there's the I guess prostitute in the group there that she won't put up with the crap, and she's ready to get killed for it. She doesn't care if they kill her. She's not going to put up with the crap that these criminals are trying to give them. So this one little dirtbag decides that if she'll screw Lone Wolf right there in front of everybody, that they'll let her live. They think that Lone Wolf is so terrified that he'll do whatever he has to do, but he's doing it to protect her, and she's the only one that realizes it. And so that's the part of it that really shows that, I mean, he could have just sat there and not done anything and let them kill her. What would have mattered to him? It matters more in the story as the story goes on from that point, because she was there to find him. But he didn't know that at this point either. Not that it also really would have mattered in the grand scheme of things. But he's willing to sacrifice what he can sacrifice. He, at no time is he worried more about face than he's worried about not letting people manipulate him so he can always keep the upper hand.
Exactly. You know, even when he seems he's in the dire straits, he's kind of where he wants to be. Like, I guess that takes it back to the other story, like when he's in the prison.
Yeah, oh, God, I love that story. That one might, the hot springs might be my favorite, the prison one with the arsonist might be my favorite.
Yeah, because you're sitting there, it's like, well, what's he doing? So he gets himself thrown in prison, then he starts a riot, so he kills some people, so he gets himself thrown on death row, so he can get into the same cell with this guy, and it's an arsonist, and then he's set up stuff in there from, like, a week earlier, or 3 days earlier, because he knew he was going to put himself in this exact situation so he could, you know, hit his mark and get out.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, not only do you see the level of planning that he has and how perfect everything has to be planned, but the balls on the guy. Like, he's unflappable. Like, nothing gets to him. You know, yeah. He's not afraid of death. He's not afraid of killing people. He's not afraid of getting the crap beat out of him when he has to take it. He's not afraid of losing face. Like, at no time does ego supersede anything else. It's just, God, I really did love that story. And that's one where it's extra satisfying because you're getting the revenge of it. It comes down to the person who hired him. And I also love the reveal of that story. There's some of the stories where you don't know why what's going on is going on, and it doesn't get revealed till towards the end of the story. That in the one with the arsonist, he was hired by the wife or the daughter of the warden who had to commit seppuku because an arsonist started a fire in the prison, and he had to let them out. And he had to give them the honor system of coming back.
Yeah, that was the thing too. It's like, yeah, so if there's a fire, protocol is you let all the prisoners go. You tell them, and they're supposed to be honorable enough to come back. And some of them didn't come back. So since they didn't come back, the warden had to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. And then to add to those elements, the intricacy of the story, because it's not just as simple as that revenge. There's another level to the revenge here.
Yeah, because I think he was hired to kill the arsonist, but then he gets in and he finds out that the arsonist was hired by the deputy warden, and that, oh, by the way, the 12 people that didn't come back, well, 11 of them I saw killed, and they were deposited, not shown. That's why they didn't come back. So everybody did come back. So it was a total setup, and, you know, so at that point, you know, I think that's one of the things where he's – the mark he's been told is the person who dishonored my father so that he had to commit seppuku. So it wasn't – he found out it wasn't the arsonist, which I guess we've run the story for him. It wasn't the arsonist. It was for the guy inside that the deputy warning that hired the arsonist. And then he got his just desserts.
Yeah, and see, I think in this story too, I think that – that she knew that this new warden was at the root of things, but didn't have any proof or didn't know the truth of it. So the way that it was that the mission was conducted in a way to draw that out. The arsonist told the story, but then also when that warden came in, he also kind of gave up the truth of what happened too, and he didn't know that Lone Wolf was right there to hear him and then kill him. So it just the intricacies of it was just great. I mean, it was just like the other story where just there's all these moving pieces, and you don't quite know how they're going to settle till right at the very end, and they all come together.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah, for me that's the first story of Volume 2. So yeah, now you know that's the first story after you find out his history, that he was the Shogun's executioner. Then you get to this prisoner thing. So I guess that helps explain why he knew all the protocols for, what happens if a prison burns, what are the prisoners supposed to do? They're supposed to come back. This is why the ward would have to kill himself. This is how you get on death row. This is where death row's at. You know, if I'm going to be in death row, I need to put this stuff, make this stuff accessible so I can get to it. So I guess death row is just one big room they throw you in, everybody that's on it.
Yep.
and he placed this in there like 3 days before and just went to the plan and it just worked, and it's just a thing of beauty when you see all, when you get to the end of a story and you see how he had to sequence everything, and then you get to the next story and you get to see that again, how he set up the situation, and he gets through it, does his thing. You know, maybe something unexpected will come up. He gets through it and he goes on to the next one. It's almost like he's just totally, since he's on this path, you know, he's got the demon in him. He's doing the path of the demon, path of the assassin. There's like nothing can stand against him because he's got this frame of mind, and he's just, that makes him do these actions that just makes him unbeatable. You know, and it just keeps getting reinforced, because then, you know, people will look into his eyes or look into his son's eyes and they're like, oh, there's a lot of death been seen by those eyes. I'm not messing with that.
And that's what makes the story about the Osu so great, too, is on its own it's good. But then when you see stories like this one where he is so intricate that you don't see it coming. And then when it's you know, when it's up and you're about to be killed, and you realize that everything that you thought was in your favor was planned to get to this moment, to kill you exactly how it was meant to happen, you understand why these people in the Osu story were so damn paranoid. Like, their paranoia was totally justified, because you know what? If he was going to come and kill you, those were the kind of things he would have done.
You know? Exactly. I mean, it's like when he shows up, it's like you know you're screwed, because he's already got everything manipulated such that you're right where he wants you to be. He's where he wants to be, and you're just waiting for him to, you know, do the stroke or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah. So I think the last story that we didn't talk too much about that really stood out to us is the one with the brothers. So they're hired to protect basically an informant. So when two Hans are at odds with each other, and the Shogunate decides the case, they send people to basically tell their sides of the story, and when one side knows they're going to lose, they try to just assassinate the other side, because that way it kills their case.
Yeah, so exactly.
These three brothers were hired to protect somebody. And we start off the story seeing them get tested and seeing them use... And just everything about them is set up to be... I mean, almost to make them otherworldly. Like, they have the, I don't know the name of it, but the big kind of...
Yeah, like I don't really, know what you call it.
Yeah, they're really wide-brim, the kind of triangle-shaped, wide-brim circle hats that really kind of hide what's going on. The one guy has like the bear claw that he uses, and they brutally kill these people that are testing him and trying to take him down. It's something that really kind of sets them apart. Like, it's almost like they're gods or demons, you know? And that was the one where Lone Wolf is just sitting there against the wall, and they see that there's something about him, just like he's able to see their stuff about them. They throw the knife right by his head. He just ignores it. When they ask for it back, without even opening his eyes, he grabs it out of the wall and throws it straight into the scabbard.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because then they start talking, and it's like, oh, well, you know, because he knows that when he does that they know who he is.
Yeah, so he doesn't care. Game recognizes game right there. They both know. They know what the other are, and they know that because they're running into each other, there's a reason for it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and they go, and he goes, well, if you know I'm an assassin, why'd you have me come along with you? It's like, well, if we can see you, we know where you are. So it's like, you know, it's the whole keep your enemies closer thing they're doing, exactly like that. It's like, if you're on the boat, we know where you are, so you can't go and get your mark if you're with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all throughout the story, it's kind of, they build up your respect of these three brothers, because you see their height of skill is just impressive. So just like we're impressed by Lone Wolf, because we know he can go into any situation and take on, you know, any number of foes and come out on top, these guys are the same. We know that they're both hired for a job, so these are people that are just, they're doing their job. And just like with Lone Wolf, we root for him to get through his job successfully, because he's our protagonist. This is one where the antagonist would be a protagonist in another story, so we're kind of a you know, conflict here, where you don't really want to see them have to die, because you know what? You would totally love a story that was just about them, too.
No, but exactly.
It's good. They're going to have to throw down, and when it comes down to it, these three brothers who are all hugely impressive in what they can do lose to one guy.
Yep. And what's interesting also is, I mean, they get there talking, and it's like, so they sit there and say, yeah, we know who you were. We know you're an assassin, but we don't know if you're after our target, so honor bound, we had to bring you with us. And it's like, then, you know, Lone Wolf goes, well, then why don't you strike me down? It's like, well, because you said, and we haven't confirmed you're after our target, so honor dictates we can't strike you. But the boat's burning, so we can escape. You can't, so that takes care of our issue with you. So, yeah, so at this time, they're on the boat, and I forget how it catches on fire. So then they're having this, like, honor discussion while this boat's burning around
them. On the boat, they see the opportunity to take down these brothers because they know they can't fight them, but they know that if they just burn the boat they're on, what are they going to do?
Oh, yeah, they're getting into the boat, and then they pour the oil on them, and they throw a torch in it, but then they burn up their own boat they're traveling in.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get to these stories, the peasants are not depicted very brightly. And or the non-warrior cast is not portrayed as very intelligent.
Yeah, it seems like with the peasants, there's two types. There's either the ones that just accept that their fate will be their fate, and if they're gonna die, they're gonna die, and they're gonna do the best they can, do the right thing as much as they can. And then there are the peasants that are terrified of everything and think that they can fight against it, but when they're fighting against it, nobody's there to protect them. So they're fighting against forces that are professionals at what they're doing. So, I mean, like in this case, they're trying to fight against three professional killers, basically. And that's just the stupid. It's pretty stupid to do. You're a peasant. You know, it's like, stay away and hope they're not there to kill you. That's pretty much your best bet. If you try to kill them, then, you know what, if they weren't there to kill you, they're going to kill you now because you tried to kill them.
Exactly. And I think this is one of the only stories where you see the fight sequence that's not Lone Wolf or Cub involved in it. Because the three brothers, they kind of get attacked by a mob of sword-wielding peasants. And you see one's got the katana, one's got the bear claws, and one's got the club. And you know, so you do get a little bit more depiction, because then you have the one panel where the guy hits the other, where the brother, whacks the one peasant in the back of the head with the club, and you see his eyeballs pop out, and all it's all its detail. But it's one of the few fights. It's one of the few full fight scenes that you see where it's not got Lone Wolf and Cub in it, but it kind of shows the same sequences you usually see involved with him.
Yeah, one of the things I love about that fight too is they get to the end of it, and one of the brothers chides one of the other brothers for allowing there to be blood spray.
Yes.
And he's basically really, blood spray against these guys? Like, you need to practice.
Yeah.
not that he got struck, not that he got injured. There was blood spray as they butchered these thugs that were hired to kill them.
Yes, yeah, that was funny. I remember that now, yeah. It's like, you need to practice more.
Well, any last thoughts on Lone Wolf and Cub? I think we've pretty thoroughly talked about this. I don't think there's any other stories that really warrant more in-depth discussion.
No, it's just they start to get a little bit better. Well, I don't think I'm going to say a little bit better. I mean, the previous stories were good, and it continues to go on. There's an interesting story that comes up, and not too soon after this, that you can look forward to, where the entire story is based on the exact way or the proper way to decapitate a person. because apparently when you're doing seppuku, so you're on your knees, and this is how the executioners had to practice. You had to cut the head off in such a way that their head would fall in their lap. And there's an entire story dedicated to that aspect of feudal Japan.
That's awesome. And those kind of intricacies are what make Lone Wolf and Cub and Usagi Yojimbo and things like that so good. It ties in so much of history and the details of what's happening. Telling the story of the details can be such a compelling story. We're just so used to stories being focused on the action, and the details are secondary. You've been listening to episode 9 of the Comics in Black and White podcast. We talked about Lone Wolf and Cub. Join us next time when we will be talking about Sean Murphy and Punk Rock Jesus. A book that actually, when I got into comics, when I first really was getting into comics and I started going to my first real LCS, that was the first book suggested to me was Punk Rock Jesus, and I was not interested at the time. I finally read it, thanks to Jay, who was with us recently for the Love and Rockets podcast episode that we did. He'll be back with us for Punk Rock Jesus, possibly with another guest. That'll be our next episode, so read up on that. And just to get a head start, start reading SX County, because that'll be coming behind it, and that has a little bit more meat to it. Thank you again, Dennis, for joining me on this episode. We look forward to having – well, we – I. It's just I now. It's no longer a we show. I look forward to having you on future episodes, including ElfQuest, another meaty one that if you're into that, you should start reading so you can be ready for it. Where can folks give you some feedback on how they liked this?
Oh, well, I'm in the Valiant Central Facebook group. I'm on the Slack channel. I do have a Twitter account at UTENGR that I usually check about once a month or so. I do not know the Twitter. That is that age that gives my age about me and my Twitter usage.
Yeah, so thanks for joining me on this. Between you and Jay, I think we are going to have our two Steve Martins of the podcast that are regular recurring members with me. So, yeah. So
That's because we're the old guys before they had color for comics.
Yeah, sir. I know it's great. Both of you guys are like, oh, you should read this. Here, I mailed it to you. What?
It's somebody to share the obsession with.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to, and that's why I wanted to do this podcast, is to talk about things that we love that are a little bit offbeat, and I think between you and Jay, I've found two kindred spirits in the world of offbeat, interesting, meaty, meaningful comics, and Poison Elves.
Ah! I'll make a convert of you eventually.
I don't know, you kind of drove me off with the guy wearing the banana hammock.
Oh, the Purple Marauder. He doesn't show up that often. He serves a purpose. Every character serves a purpose.
All right. Well, until next time, you can find me on Twitter at Who's Paul. You can tweet the podcast on Twitter at CBW Podcast. That's what it is. You can email us CBWPodcast@outlook.com. Tweet Martin at Geekvine and tell him how this is the second best podcast on Nerdy Legion. It really isn't, but well, at least download wise. But I like to remind him that that I'm the best. So until next time, read up on some punk rock Jesus, some Sean Murphy. Have a good night.
Later.
Have you watched Iron Fist at all?
Yes.
So one of the criticisms with Iron Fist is that the fighting sucks in it, right?
I didn't really think that. I mean, it's like I think I was talking to the Jack Sutherland about it, and it was kind of like, I mean, it's Kung Fu, and Kung Fu's more of defensive, where you're supposed to get out of the way and let your opponent's momentum carry them or something. You know, it's not striking back, but in traditional martial arts, is you go in and you go in for that strike. It's kind of almost like MMA. You go in and you do that strike, and you just want to end it. You don't want to prolong it. And I kind of felt that's what some people's complaints about Iron Fist was. It's like there weren't any long fight sequences.
Yeah, and that's not even the element about it that bothered me, or that I was referring to that I heard about either. So the actor that plays Danny Rand in it, he hardly trained. He trained intensely for a couple of weeks, but then once filming started, filming was just so intense he wasn't able to keep up his training. And when you look at the fight scenes, I think it, like, you see that, because it's kind of like, okay, well, we have to get from point A to point B with the fights. And it's, I think, I haven't watched the whole series yet, but it gets better as the series goes on. But some of the early ones are just, I mean, they just look silly. They just absolutely look silly. It's like they're...
It looks stiff. It doesn't flow.
Have you seen Bowfinger?
I do not think so.
It's Eddie Murphy, Steve Martin. I haven't seen it in forever, so I don't remember exactly, but somebody posted a meme, or I guess a gif, of one of the scenes where Eddie Murphy's character is in, like, a kung fu movie. So guys are running up to him. He's not hitting them or anything. They're not hitting him, but they're getting their butts kicked by him because they're acting as if he was acting appropriately, right? So they're running up to him, and then they're acting like whatever he's doing is the right is like appropriate fighting. That's kind of how it feels like a little bit in Iron Fist. But my point of saying that is that in the show Iron Fist, the Netflix series, they're telling the story, and the lack of emphasis on the training for the fighting is apparent. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of emphasis on the details of what's going on, and you know that's kind of what we're used to with a lot of movies and comics and stuff like that. You get more focused on the big bang moments and progressing the story along that you lose sight of the details that really are what make the story great. So reading something like Lone Wolf and Cub, Usagi Yojimbo, watching a movie like Seven Samurai, where the story really is small. It's a small story as far as like length of the story, but they get so into the details without it being mundane that it makes it magnificent.
Yes, exactly. And it's been a while since I've seen Seven Samurai, so now I'm going to have to go watch it again.
Yeah, I watched that one Sunday. I was like, you know what, damn it, I'm just going to watch this. It's hard for me to find time to watch stuff because I have a four-year-old, and I have very little time for myself. So one Sunday I was just like, you know what, I'm just going to watch this. It's an old enough movie that the violence isn't going to be anything that would be offensive to a kid. You know, he's not going to know what's going on with the violence. It's subtitles, so any profanity isn't going to be heard. That movie was 3.5 hours long, and I loved it, but I was like, man.
Yeah, it's a long movie.
Hard to fit in with a four-year-old. I'd have to pause it occasionally and go play with him, but it was definitely well worth it.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Oh, you know that, and all that talking, maybe, did you see that in the story where the guy, he had the duel with him, and he got the, and then it was the final duel, and it was a slice such that it whistled? When he was breathing, and he's like, oh, I thought I'd never hear the perfect cut.
And then I heard it on my own neck.
That pretty much epitomizes it. It's just, Lone Wolf and Cub is just a great story. I wish I'd gotten into it a lot sooner.
Yeah, some comics, some books, whatever they're... You read them and you can know that they're good, but they'll be just hard to get through sometimes, or they'll have their high points and their low points. And then some are just, they're so good and so compelling that they're good in the short run, they're good in the long run. They keep you moving through it so quickly. You just, not only do you want to see what happens next, but you're happy living in the moment. And that's really what I felt like with this book, is it's like, I'm not just trying to get to the next page to get the next cliffhanger. But I want to absorb this story, and then as soon as I'm done with it, I want another one. So I'm looking forward to getting more of it, definitely. It's one of those ones that you just kind of keep rolling through, and you can stop and pick it up later, too, because it's not one of the... You know, you read some books that if you take a break from them, you're going to be lost when you come back. I don't think that'd be the case with this one either, so...
No, like I said, I read it over the course of 12 years, and... I mean, it just parts of it stick with you once you get the little backstory. I mean, maybe some of the details on how it went down between the Yagyu clan and the Ogami clan I may have lost, but you know the basic premise. Mm-hmm. And and over 12 years, it was very good. It was quite enjoyable to read the first part again. I'm really thinking about rereading the whole thing
Of course, I still got Frank Miller's Ronin here. I got to get into, so I'm kind of in my
Semirim. Yeah, that I read that. I always wanted to read that because it was a major influence on Ninja Turtles.
I read the first issue, and I've got the other five here that I've got to get through.
God, it's only six issues long?
Yeah, it's only six issues.
Oh, it felt like so much more than that.
Well, I guess that gives your opinion on that, then.
Yeah, it wasn't horrible. Like, I was complaining about it to somebody, and they're like, well, why don't you just quit reading it? I'm like, it's not that level of bad, but...
It's not walk out of the movie bad?
It's also kind of tedious. It's one of those where you're like, you get through to the parts where you're like, oh man, I don't know. You're like, well, I know that this is an important movie, so I'm just going to keep watching it, you know, and you get to the end and you're like, I guess I'm glad I saw that, but man, you know, that's kind of how it is. So I would definitely dive into it and get through it, but let's just say I'm glad that I bought it as inexpensively as possible. It was like $6 on a digital Comixology sale. It may do a little bit better actually having it physically there with you, though.
Yeah, maybe. Well, you see, I'm a collector, and yeah. So I know I there was a good deal on eBay, and I got it, and they're in good shape, and I will go into my collection.
How much did you buy it for, if you don't mind me asking?
I think I bought it for $20.
That's not bad. I mean, it's something that's it's a monumental thing. So,
yeah, they originally were in the collection. They're originally at $250 each. It's from like the early '80s, so like cover price would have been $15 about, and I got it for $20 with shipping.
So modern cover price would be $24, so it's a steal.
Exactly. Yeah. So, oh, then I know what I need to find sometime and send you to get in your queue for Comics in Black and White. I need to find Tyrant for you. There's not one spoke. It only came, there was only four issues. Spider Baby was the name of the comic company, and there are no spoken words in the entire none of the issues. It was supposed to be the series about the life of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and the first issue is when he hatches.
That sounds great. If you get that for me, we will definitely do that. When we talked before, have you read Usagi Yojimbo?
I have not. The only issue I have read is the very first issue from Fantagraphics, which I think you now have.
Yes, I do. Thank you very much.
I did read it before I shipped it to you.
So I think that you should read, especially doing this Lone Wolf and Cub, I think that you should read Usagi, and we should do an episode on Usagi at some point.
Okay, I'll look into it. There's a few volumes, huh?
Yeah, so depending on how much you trust me and really want to dive into it, Martin and I have done an Usagi podcast, and we focused more on the Fantagraphics, the first two omnibi. Those you can get. The cover price is like $70, but you can get them for 40-something through various ways. So if you do want to get those, let me know. But the Dark Horse volumes, Dark Horse has 7 omnibi out of it so far, and they're like, I think, $25 cover price. So if you can't get it for like $17, then you're not trying. So I would just say, Unless you're super confident and you want to read through 3 omnibi before we do it, just get the first Dark Horse one and read it.
Okay, well, let me look
into
it.
I'm only on the second one myself, by the way, so you wouldn't be too far away.
Like I say, I frequent a bunch of shops, and I frequent a bunch of used bookstores and things, so...
Yeah, pick some up and
see what pops up.
Yeah, well, we only talked about those first two Fantagraphics, so you know as long as we get at least somewhat past that, then we'll be able to talk about some new stuff. But especially having done Lone Wolf and Cub, I think that one, I think you'll really like it, and two, I think it'll be interesting talking about it with somebody who has that added perspective.
Okay, yeah, I've been meaning to kind of get into it. I've just had a few other things I've been involved in, like this Ronin, and well, yeah, I got ElfQuest on. I thought that omnibus would be here already. Well, y'all got me on Bone, so I ordered the omnibus on Bone, and I did read that. Actually, I've got it sitting here. I was going to keep it, but I may get rid of it now. I mean, it's just been sitting there now for taking up space. I kind of liked having it in my collection, but
Yeah, that's one that I bought before quite a while back. I read it. I got rid of it at some point. I mean, this was when we were in California, so to be fair, we moved 3,000 miles across country. So we got rid of a lot of stuff. And then I finally got it again. The one thing with Bone, and this is why I'll keep the omnibus now, and I haven't even finished rereading the whole thing. I've only read the first couple of, what would have been individual trades of it. Just that first trade worth of stuff, there's just so many fantastic things in it. And those are the things that have never left me. And rereading it, realizing that just about everything that I never forgot about Bone happened in the first trade was pretty impressive.
Yeah, even though I hadn't read it before, I do have a few of the first issues, and I still love that scene when he's sitting on the branch. Oh, those rat creatures won't jump down here. Stupid, stupid rat creatures.
Yeah, that's one of the great moments.
This is the best.
There's a few that are just so great. That's one thing that I may do eventually is get the individual issues and then ditch the omnibus, but it's definitely a good read. It's so great to have so many great things out there to read that there's so much content that you can get for so cheap. I mean, what's the cover price on that Bone omnibus? Like $35 maybe?
$39.95. Okay, I think so, this is a first edition.
Yeah, so a $40 omnibus, and if you can't get a book for like 30% off, then you really need to look around a little bit more because it's not hard to do. So you should get that Bone omnibus for under $30.
I got it for $15 off eBay.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
And I saw posted about Terry Moore's soft cover omnis on half price until the 18th. So I was thinking about SIP.
Okay, so we actually figured this out because they charge ridiculous shipping. The plus The plus if you get it from him is the money is going to Terry Moore. So there's no middleman that's getting part of the money. So that's a plus.
And Mike can talk him into signing it.
Yeah, exactly. He actually, I saw in the comments somebody asked him on Twitter, and he said, yeah, just send me a message or send a follow-up email right away. So if you get SIP, it actually comes out in your favor by a little bit, even with the high shipping cost, because the price on in-stock trades compared to it, you still actually save $3.50. The other ones, you would be spending more than you can get them on in-stock trades.
Well, I actually have the singles of Echo and Rachel Rising, so SIP's the only stuff of his I haven't read. But my LCS has the Omni hardcovers that's been sitting on there display for like over a year or two, so I'm thinking about going in there and seeing if it'll take $50 for
them. The SIP hardcovers?
Yep. The two volume.
I would suggest getting those because they're hard to find. So if you can get a deal out of them, get them.
Yeah, they're just sitting there, and I've been wondering, collecting dust, I've been wondering if I offered $50 if they'd just sell them to me to get them out, to move them.
Before you go offer $50, look on eBay and see what they're going for, because I'm pretty sure that they probably are going for a high price. So go in and offer $50, see what he counters with, and then probably take it. Because those are, I think they're out of print, the hardcover ones. So.
Yeah, but they're still sealed, and then I won't want to break the seal. And I can't read them.
Well, whatever. See, the thing with out of print is even if you break the seal and read them, they're still going to be more valuable than what you're going to pay for them.
Yeah, true. So, I may do
Terry Moore fans are the kind of fans that would seek out that stuff. So it's the kind of thing that's not going to lose its value because Terry Moore will always have that hardcore fan base.
Yeah, and you know what? I just don't understand somebody that doesn't like his art.
Yeah, Aaron probably doesn't even listen to this.
I mean, his art is just awesome. But yeah, I've been trying to keep my eye out for Tyrant to send you because I think I would say it's a fun read, but there's nothing to read.
Some of those stories are great. I was just talking about Hawkeye with somebody and a couple of friends actually. I loved Matt Fraction's Hawkeye, and they kind of ruined it for me when they pointed out the weak points of Fraction's writing, which over time I've kind of realized Fraction, he's good, but he's not the greatest. What made Hawkeye so great is that Fraction's good, but Aha's art was really what put it over the top. And there are a couple of issues in Hawkeye that are like that are almost no words in them. but they're just such beautiful issues because the art is done so well and the scripting is done so well in it. So yeah, if you come, I'll keep my eye out for Tyrant too. I mean, I don't have many opportunities to come across stuff, but you never know.
Well, I've been looking at it in my comic shops that I hit, and I have yet to see it in the dollar bins or anything like that. And on eBay, I'll see where they have issues 1 through 3, and then they'll have issue 4 scarce, and they'll have like wanting $20 for it. So, I mean, I sent you those five poison elves I sent you. I think I got those for like $11, so it was like way less than cover when nice. I found them. But that reminds me, I gotta get those. I do have some stuff to mail. I do have those Poison Elves trades, and I think those Turoks I promised you like a couple of weeks ago, and some other stuff that I gotta get shipped out.
You could send the Poison Elves stuff. Just go ahead and send it on to Sparkman.
Oh, too late. It's already boxed up.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, I'll check it. Like, I am interested in checking it out. I don't think I'll like literally read every bit of it, but I'll read some of it. I'll leave through. I kind of want to get a sense of what happens, but then I'll send them on to Sparkman afterwards.
Yeah, but if nothing, what you'll enjoy is reading the. So he's got different starting notes for the volumes, and then he also has somebody do a forward. So he has Brian Michael Bendis does a forward where they talk about their fake feud. They talk about whoever the author of ElfQuest is. Apparently they were doing dueling ads in previews in Diamond at one time where they were each calling out each other's works. Like, I don't make any cute elves and stuff like that. So they were taking out half page ads against each other. And one of those guys wrote the forward, and there was a couple of other people. His mom wrote a forward for him.
Yeah, see, that's the stuff I'll read all of that stuff because that stuff really interests me. The issues, I'll read through them kind of quickly, scanning them, but who knows? Maybe I'll get hooked in too.
Well, I mean, that's fair. But the thing is, like the first volume, he did not like his art for the first two issues. So the first two issues are not reprinted in the trade paperback. He writes them out. So it's almost he does a novella of the first two issues. And then you start with the artwork with like issues 3, 4 ongoing. So
is that the first two issues of like
the Mulehide? Yeah, the first. Yeah. What we went over was the first 6, 5 issues of Sirius. Before that, he self-published under his Mulehide Graphics himself. That's the first 5 trade paperbacks, or those first 20 issues. I had never read those before until like last week. And then again, it's like the first two issues, he didn't even do the artwork. He didn't reprint that because he didn't like his art style. He wanted to redraw it. So I still have to go find it. I found on eBay those first 20 issues where there was a set for $275. And nobody bought it. Now there's another set on there for $500. So that's what the first 20 issues are going for. So we'll see if I eventually get it.
Yeah, but comic collecting is so crazy because you'll stuff like that, because it's so scarce, will be listed for such a high price, but it's also the kind of thing that, because how many people are seeking that out? I mean, there's enough people to fetch the price, but there's also little enough that there's the chance, long shot chance, but it happens where you'll stumble across it in like a flea market for a buck an issue or something like that.
Well, I know, but you see, that's why I can't figure out some of this. Like I don't want to pick on Valiant. Some of their variants and such, you know, they're 1 in 10s, 1 in 20s, 1 in 50s. You know, I can understand the scarcity, but they're scarce, but there's also a limited number of people that are seeking it out.
Mm-hmm. Did Ed said when we had them on for 100th episode, he said 1 in 10s and 1 in 20s. There is nothing about them that really makes them valuable. Like, they're not the speculators. Those aren't speculator books. There's too many of them. Yeah, so it's when you get higher than that the speculation starts.
Well, it's even the 1 in 50s. If you don't... How many people are buying the Marvel and the DC books compared to the Valiant? Valiant books. You can just see that on the sales. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have that many people looking for it, how does it get the price up? And then I asked that question, and you know, that Bloodshot Platinum number 0, that's
on eBay sold for $1,700 today.
Yeah, see, and, oh god, so the Bloodshot Zeros from VH1, the
Platinum, the Air. The Air one.
The Air one. There's only yeah. like,
they're like five in existence or something like
see,
that.
See, I think that's funny. That's like, I don't know. Like, I think that that's the kind of thing that you can call that a scarce variant, or you can call that a piece of trash. But enough people think it's valuable that it makes it valuable.
Well, it's only valuable because it's different, and the difference isn't intentional.
Yeah, and the difference is it's a flaw, and there could be other flaws that nobody would give a crap about in books. You know, it's just it's one that enough people are like, this is the only one.
Well, it's so like that it's I got
valuable.
Well, you know that VH1. I got what the Magnus 50, where it's got there's error ones where they misnumbered the page, where the pages are in the wrong order. You know, I got some of that. That's an error. You know, it's still a dollar book.
Yeah, exactly. Some aren't going to be worth it. I don't know. I think that's that Bloodshot, the one, there's only one in existence. There's only one that you know of that was screwed up slightly differently than the other screwed up one, so you think it's more valuable. But, you know, whatever. I mean, what's crazy is it has that value, and it's not like that's a randomly popped up value that's gone away. It's kept that value, so it like legitimately has that value to collectors now.
Well, I'm not doubting the value, and somebody will pay. You know, something's worth what somebody will pay for it. I just, and maybe you know, comic book collecting Valiant, maybe they can talk about it. It's just what gives a scarce comic its value? Its scarcity? Its desirability? Both.
I was actually talking to Dwan specifically about that book, and I said, you guys need to talk about this because I'm calling shenanigans on that one. But yeah, I was talking about it to Martin too, that it is like not only is it scarcity, but it's the desire of people to have it. You know, certain things become a grail to enough people that suddenly it has a value to it. I can relate it more for myself to when I collected sports cards for a while. When I first started collecting, what kind of got me hooked was I got a one-of-one card. So it's the only one in existence. And it was super cool. It was a printing plate from the card that they made for this set. And it was autographed, and it was a rookie card. The way they do the autograph is they actually have them autograph like a clear label that they put on the card. So it was actually a metal printing plate. So it was just, like, super cool. I mean, when I collected cards as a kid, the coolest things that existed were die-cut cards those are meaningless now, you know? The card's worthless because the player busted. The player never made anything of himself. So it's the only one in existence of that. Only one of that specific thing. But it doesn't matter because, you know what, there are three other printing plates from that specific card, but they do that for other card sets too, and the player doesn't matter. Whereas you can get a card for the most valuable card I ever got in a pack that I sold for $400, and that was an Andrew Luck autographed rookie card. And it wasn't the scarcest card, but that was worth $400. This other one that I had that was the only one in existence, I probably sold for like $10 or $15.
Yeah.
So the demand is such a big part of it. People have to want it. And so going back to what you were saying about Valiant books, A&A, the Rafer Roberts series, they did 1 in 50s for that. Those aren't really worth anything. The Britannia 1 in 50s are worth a lot, especially number 2 for some reason.
Yeah, but from a lot of the Valiant fans didn't care for Britannia, so where's the desirability?
Enough people did care about it. I think it's also a title that can appeal to outside of just Valiant fans. So people who are just collectors, you know, like Britannia doesn't have to be... You don't have to be steeped in Valiant to have some kind of appeal for Britannia. The art also, I think this is where there's a big difference with Britannia, is the art isn't black and white versions of the A cover. It's Dave Johnson art, so he's a very good cover artist. So the art is really, really good. But then with Savage, it's black and white variants of the cover art. But I think where that works out better is it's like Louis LaRosa art. And Louis LaRosa art looks good as a black and white variant. Whereas with A&A, the cover art was David LaFuente. Is that his name? Did I get that right? I think it's David LaFuente.
I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah. And his art, it looks like a coloring book if it's black and white. You know, it's not spectacular in black and white. So there's different factors that play into it. But I think with Valiant, the mini series that have 1 in 50s, those 1 in 50s do better than 1 in 50s for the maxi series that they do.
Yeah, I'm a full collector. I get the scare stuff that I like and things. It's just, you know, with the speculating and stuff that I hear about and everything, it's just like, how does one decide what is scarce and desirable?
Yeah, and I think that's where the difference between speculating and being a speculator and being a collector are two very different things. Being a speculator, you are a collector to an extent, but you're a collector who is looking at the value, and that's kind of what drives your collecting passion. Mm-hmm. So like speculators do a lot of, from what I've seen, it's been interesting seeing this, do a lot of, getting CGC copies, understanding when it's worth pressing a book, and then getting it CGC'd. There was somebody actually that made a post on the Valiant Fans Facebook page about this that went into pretty thorough detail about stuff. I found it very interesting. So that's speculators. You know, they're the ones that that made, what the hell was it, like Bloodshot number 6 go from being a worthless comic book to one that had some value to it, because it's the first Colin King. Whereas collectors, like, you're a collector, I'm a collector. When we collect something, the monetary value, I think it adds some excitement to it for us. But monetary value doesn't supersede the value that it has to us.
Well, the monetary value only matters if you're going to flip it.
Exactly. Like when I collected sports cards, because I cleared out my sports card collection when I realized that was too expensive of a hobby and I couldn't do that and comics. I only kept one set of cards that was a lot of work to put together. But everything else I sold and got rid of. I lost money on most of it, made money on a little bit of it. But it didn't matter at that point. But when I had the cards, like say, for example, I'm a 49ers fan, and one of my prized cards was I had a Colin Kaepernick autographed rookie card. Now, I bought it for $20 before he started starting at all. You know, he was nobody. So just run-of-the-mill card didn't mean anything. When he was the most successful, it went up to being worth like probably $250. And that was exciting. Like, it was exciting to be like, oh, man, I have this card. It's worth $250. But I didn't love the card because it was worth $250. I loved the card because it was my Colin Kaepernick rookie card. And just added some excitement to it that it had grown in value like that. I ended up selling it for around $100 because by then the 49ers were starting to fall apart. He was starting to struggle, so there wasn't all that excitement behind it. And I didn't care. I mean, you could say I lost out on $150, but I didn't buy it to get the most I could out of it. I bought it because I'm a 49ers fan and I was collecting. So I think that's kind of the difference between collectors and speculators. And that's where, you know, so, that one Divinity 1 in 40, I forget for what issue. I think it's number one, the Louis LaRosa one.
I think it is.
I didn't like it. I thought it was an ugly cover. There's something about the art, and I love Louis LaRosa's art, but it looked funny to me. I did not like that cover. I had the chance to get it, but I didn't like it, so I didn't get it. And then it blows up in value like crazy. And so, you know, part of me kind of wants to be like, oh, man, I could have had that, and I could have made money off of it. But I know that when it comes down to it, I never would have bought it because I didn't want it. That's the big difference.
Yeah, I can see that, and that's kind of
some of the thoughts I've had on it.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand why certain, and this is, you know, it goes to Valiant, why certain Valiant 1 in 50s basically do better than other 1 in 50s. And it's not really with the number printed. And I think this all got me thinking about it when they did that 1 in 500 for X01.
Yeah.
When you're sitting there trying to price it. And yeah, I think it's come down from what, $800 to about $500 now.
Yeah, and I know people that have gotten it for a lot less. I know people that have worked out deals to essentially, with the complexity of the deals, get it for free because they worked out a deal where they bought this other stuff, and or maybe they sold this other stuff. They did a little bit of this and that. So, you know, I've heard a variety of deals. I think the people that got good deals, like the consensus really good deal, was probably around $200, and it probably involved, like, buying the other covers, or it was a shop that's able to sell a lot. They're not trying to gouge the person that wants that. Like, that's where the shop is buying loyalty. You sell a 1 in 500 book for $200, you're buying loyalty with that. And I'm sure, you know, they're making sure that they're that, you know, the dollars they get at the end of the day are working out for them. That's a book where making a 1 in 500 book is manufacturing the scarcity. And that's the kind of thing I wouldn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. Like, I would have to love something to want to get into that mess. And you know what? I don't love XO enough to even mess with that. I love reading XO, but I don't have that collecting passion for XO. But a book like, the Britannia number 2, 1 in 50. I don't know why number 2 is worth so much more than the other ones, but it is. I know that there was something funny with that. It didn't come out the week it was supposed to, and nobody could find it. I had a lot of people asking me about that, because at that time I was getting my hands on quite a few variants for people. But for some reason, that book is worth, I want to say, a couple hundred bucks on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And that's not manufactured scarcity. That's because there's actual scarcity to the book. There's the demand because it's, you know, a beautiful cover, a known artist. Britannia has that kind of buzz around it. So, yeah, there really is a difference. Like, Valiant's interesting when it comes to variants. That's obviously, like, the variant kind of market that I know the best myself, from playing in it a little bit myself and then having the opportunity to get my hands on some to sell other people and just kind of seeing how they really do. Yeah, I mean, so many of the variants, they're just,
you know, I mean, I get the variants I like.
Yeah.
If I see them and I really like the cover, then I get it.
Yeah, when I started building a Valiant collection again, I was able to get my hands on some of the variants that I liked that I had let go before when I sold my whole collection. You know, I was working on towards buying the house, and I was able to get some of them for $1. At Newbury Comics, they were clearing out all their old stuff, and some of the variants that I would have dropped, you know, more like, I don't know, $10 on. I would never spend a fortune on variants unless, like, I really, really loved them. But I was able to get a bunch of them for $1. You just can't beat that. But, I mean, it just goes to show the difference between I need to have this because I'm compulsively collecting it, so I'll pay whatever it's going for right now, and what's the real value of this?
Yeah. Exactly.
I was so pissed off. I realized that I think I actually turned – this is stupid Skype recorder. I think I actually had turned it off. It normally kicks on automatically, and that was the one time I didn't check to make sure that it kicked on was that out doing that podcast. Cool. Well, thanks again for joining me. And, yeah, anything you want to do, let me know, and if it's something I can get my hands on or if you help me get my hands on it or whatever, I'm open to anything for this. So I'm excited about that Tyrant.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it.
Yeah, but even other stuff, let me know, and I'll start. I think you should check out Usagi. Let me know when you do, and I think that you'll get hooked, and we'll do a second Usagi episode.
Okay, I'll keep my eye out, see what I can find.
You'll find it. I trust you.
Well, if there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. All right, I'll catch you later.
All right, night.
Good night.